nigh all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the state of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you. You may be seated. And good morning to everyone, and thank you to the Creighton Law School and to all of you students for hosting us today. We will start with introductions from the court. I am Mike Havakin, and I am the Chief Justice. And now the other members of the court will introduce themselves by order of seniority as to service on the court.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller Lerman.
Good morning. William Capsule.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
Good morning. Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Patrick. Good morning.
I'm John Friedrich.
Thank you, members of the court. Our first case this morning is State versus Saros. Counsel, you may approach your respective counsel tables. And Mr. Mattis, good morning to you. You may approach, but just one second. Mr. Lewis, also good morning to you. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
Nothing at this time.
No questions, John.
Very good. Then, Mr. Mattis, you may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Timothy Mattis. I am the Platte County Public Defender, and my office does represent the appellant, Joel Saros, in this appeal. This is an excessive sentence appeal from the District Court of Platte County, Nebraska, following a resentencing after a revocation of a sentence of probation. The appellant in this case had originally been sentenced to a term of 18 months of probation for a 3A felony attempted possession of marijuana with intent to distribute. A short time after the original sentence was imposed, the appellant was arrested in neighboring Butler County and charged with DUI, motor vehicle homicide, possession of marijuana, and possession of drug paraphernalia. During the pendency of that case, the Platte County attorney filed a motion to revoke the appellant's probation based on those alleged law violations. The appellant eventually pleaded to the drug paraphernalia count in that case in Butler County, and then also went to trial and was convicted of a manslaughter class 2A felony, which conviction he is also appealing in this court. In this case, though, after his Butler County conviction, the appellant did reach a plea agreement whereby he admitted that he had violated his probation by way of a law violation for the possession of drug paraphernalia charge that he had voluntarily pled to before his trial in Butler County. The court in this case then resentenced the appellant to 1 to 2 years indeterminate sentence to run consecutive to the sentence that it had imposed in the Butler County case. The appellant then directed the filing of this appeal, and the appellant believes that the resentence imposed by the court in this case is excessive and an abuse of discretion.
Is there anything in the record that the court considered any factors it was not allowed to consider?
There is not, Your Honor. The record is actually pretty light on reasoning in general when it comes to the actual length of the sentence. Most of the reasoning that the court went into was a single paragraph of the Bill of Exceptions where it basically seems to tell Mr. Saros that it is revoking his probation because the violations happened so close in time to him being placed on probation in the first place. In the actual sentencing part of the hearing, however, the court did not go into any specific reasoning as to why it chose the sentence that it did.
When the sentencing judge gave probation in the first instance, mm-hmm. was he very clear with the defendant that if you violate, you're going to be incarcerated?
Judge Steike has always been very clear and always very thorough, and the record will show that Judge Steike did properly advise Mr. Saros as to the results and the consequences of violating probation.
So what is our standard of review here?
The standard of review here is determining whether there was an abuse of discretion when the district court sentenced Mr. Saros to 1 to 2 years indeterminate to run consecutive to the Butler County case.
And that's within the statutory guidelines?
It is within the statutory realm of penalties for a Class 3A felony. And also, since this is a 3A felony running consecutive or concurrent to a previously sentenced 2A felony, the fact that there is no post-release is a function of Nebraska statute in that situation. So the fact that there is no post-release is also lawful in this case.
When your client entered the admission to the revocation, what was the basis? Was there a factual basis given or a specific admission?
The specific admission or factual basis was that he was in possession of drug paraphernalia in Butler County as a part of that other case, and that he admitted that that was a law violation that was contradictory to the terms of his probation.
On that particular charge, was that a plea in Butler County?
Yes, he actually pled to that charge before he went to trial on the other charges. And that is...
So that stands as a conviction, not on appeal, is that correct?
That is correct.
So he did admit to the motor vehicle homicide, the manslaughter, is that correct?
No, he did not admit to that. He admitted to a single count of possession of drug paraphernalia. He did that before the trial was to commence on the motor vehicle homicide case.
So when he was sentenced in this case, mm-hmm. he had already been convicted and sentenced in the manslaughter case?
He had, yes.
And that case is under appeal.
That is true. It is. And that is another office. The Nebraska Commission on Public Advocacy was his attorney in that case. So.
How does this court know what an abuse of discretion is when a sentence is within the statutory boundaries?
Well, this court would have to find that the sentencing judge used improper reasoning when sentencing the defendant in this case. Obviously, that is very difficult since there is no specific reasoning articulated in the sentencing hearing. I believe the reason that Mr. Saros wanted this appeal was because he believed that in the absence of specific reason or articulated reasoning for the sentence that was handed down, that he was unable to know whether that reasoning was proper or not.
You're arguing this morning in front of a room filled mostly with law students who, if they were particularly astute, may have looked at our rules and seen that ordinarily someone who has a plea-based conviction and is appealing only excessive sentence does not receive oral argument. I assume you're very familiar with that principle.
I am, Your Honor.
And yet you're here this morning. Do you have any idea why that might?
It could be that in the state's responsive brief to the appellant's brief in this case, the state had originally asserted plain error with regard to the lack of imposition of post-release supervision for a 3A felony. In this case, I do not believe that the state is staying with that argument, but to address that briefly, in this situation, well, generally speaking, a Class 3A felony carries with it a mandatory term of post-release supervision, along with a determinate sentence rather than an indeterminate sentence. In this case, under Nebraska law, since Mr. Saros had already been sentenced to a Class 2A felony, which carries an indeterminate sentence, then any Class 3, 3A, or 4 felony that would be sentenced, that he would be sentenced to in order to run consecutive or concurrent to that 2A felony would then need to have an indeterminate sentence and no post-release supervision.
Let me see if I can keep up with you here. So in Butler County, without going too far into the appellate world, there's a case docketed addressing the convictions in the Butler County case.
Yes.
However, within that case, regardless of the merits that might be addressed by the appellant there, that case has within it a plea to the drug possession.
Yes, that is...
That's not on appeal. That sticks.
That is correct. That's what I understand, yes.
Okay. That factors into today's discussion to some extent, doesn't it?
I believe so, Your Honor. Okay. Obviously, if he was under appeal for that violation and it was overturned, then that would affect this case.
Okay, that's next month's problem.
Yes.
Thank you.
So, in this instance, it was fairly apparent from the record in this case that there was a sentence to which your client had already been sentenced in Butler County.
Yes.
But that may frequently not be apparent on the record. And in the sentencing scheme that we have with respect to post-release supervision, how is an appellate court to know, unless someone makes a specific record about it, of an existing sentence from another county or perhaps even another state?
Well, I suppose that in most appeals of that nature, that the person who is being sentenced, their attorney would bring that up at sentencing because they would not want their client to be subject to post-release supervision if he was not eligible to receive post-release supervision because of a previous conviction. I believe the only way that a court would know about that in that case then would be if somebody did have it on the record, even during the, either through the sentencing hearing or through their briefs on appeal. But I think the key there is that there has to be a record for the appeals court to be able to look at.
Do you think the appearance of that information in the pre-sentence investigation report would be sufficient to trigger an appellate court's understanding of the status?
I believe so. The pre-sentence investigation is a thorough report of the circumstances of the defendant before sentencing, and part of that is supposed to be a thorough look into that defendant's criminal history as he stands before the court. So,
are comments made by counsel during the sentencing hearing sufficient?
If they sufficiently direct the court to something that it can find, I believe so. Obviously, best practice would be to bring some sort of a certified record before the court. So. If there's nothing else, I would ask if I may withdraw.
Thank you very much. Mr. List, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. May it please the Court, Nathan List, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. I will start with Justice Cassell's question as to why we are likely here. This case is presumably moved to this court's docket based on the assertion of plain error in our brief regarding the sentence imposed set forth in the motion I filed on Monday. We are withdrawing that argument after determining that we don't have plain error here. That's no longer our position, so we are withdrawing that argument. Just briefly, with respect to the question you just asked, Justice Cassell, about the interplay and how a sentencing judge would know and whether this really is the best application of that provision. That's an interesting question. I've gone back and forth on that myself as well as with my colleagues, and I'm not really sure. I mean, you could read 29-2204.02 sub 4 either way to say that this principle is going to apply only if we're talking about sentences imposed within the same case, that if the higher class felony requires indeterminate, then the others should as well, versus, well, what happens if it's sentences imposed in other cases. In light of State v. Starks, which has already answered that question, I don't really have any basis to try to interpret the statute otherwise. But your question's valid. I've had the same concern, and if I were a sentencing judge, I'd be a bit frustrated if I was not aware of some other indeterminate sentences in another case and it's not brought to my attention, and I impose a determinate sentence as I'm required to do by statute.
Does the state or the prosecutor representing the state have some special burden to inform the court?
I'm not aware of any special burden. I mean, I would certainly hope that if the prosecution or the defense or both are aware of a prior sentence that would affect what its current sentencing court has to impose, that they would bring it to the court's attention. But I'm not aware of a burden. I suppose maybe an ethical obligation in terms of candor to the court.
In this situation, that issue was brought to the court's attention by the parties, was it not? It just no official record was made of it. And also, beyond that, the judge was the same judge in both cases.
I don't recall that the judge was the same judge. I could be. But, I mean, it was made clear on the record, including the fact that an 8 to 12 year indeterminate sentence had been imposed in Butler County. So, I mean, that was fleshed out on the record, and the sentencing judge in this case was clearly aware, and in his sentencing comment said the sentence will run consecutively to any other sentence imposed, including the sentence already imposed in Butler County.
Are comments made by the party sufficient to establish the record?
If I was a sentencing judge, I would probably want a bit more, but I think that probably is sufficient if you have the attorneys, if you're the sentencing judge and the attorneys are informing you that an indeterminate sentence was already imposed in another case. I mean, as long as you're comfortable taking them at their word, I think that would be sufficient.
Could stipulate, could they not? If both lawyers are agreeing.
They could, because that's a question of fact, which can be stipulated to. It's not a question of law. So, yes, they could. And I suppose if I was a sentencing judge, that additional step would make me feel more comfortable. But I think most sentencing judges have competent enough attorneys before them that even without a stipulation, if they're telling you, if you got a prosecutor saying this defendant was just sentenced to an indeterminate sentence in this other county or this other case, I don't think a sentencing judge is typically going to doubt that. But, yes.
Is it an admission that the defense counsel makes such a statement?
Is it an admission? Is it
an admission against interest that the court can rely upon?
Not sure if it's really an admission as opposed to just an acknowledgement of fact of something that has already happened. It's just an objective fact that somebody's been sentenced in another case to a different sentence or to a specific sentence that affects us here. I guess I'm not sure that's an admission.
Well, maybe this is more of a comment than a question, but put yourself in our shoes looking at the record to assess the assignment of error. We kind of need to know the facts so that we can assess the excessive sentence claim. Don't you agree?
The facts of the Butler County?
Yeah.
Case?
The sentence in the Butler County case, right?
Yes, but that's in our record. I mean, that was specifically hashed out, that sentence.
In one fashion or another.
Right, right. And I don't think there would be anything improper or that anything that would preclude you from taking judicial notice of that in the event that it weren't in our record. And I might have considered asking you to do so if it weren't already in our record, but since it's there, I saw no need to do that. In light of the fact that we've withdrawn the determinate versus indeterminate issue, I don't really have anything further to add on that unless the court has any other questions. I understand that's probably about the only issue you might be interested in discussing. But
do you agree with the appellant's characterization of the judge's sentencing remarks as being sort of mysterious?
No.
My word, not his.
Nothing about it seemed mysterious, as you pointed out.
Did the judge explain the reason for his sentencing?
He did. He did. And as you pointed out, when he initially imposed probation, he was crystal clear that if this doesn't go well, if you violate probation, you will be going to prison. In fact, there was some discussion or at least some gripe by the defendant as he was imposing probation about all the costs. And Judge Steinke said, well, hey, if you're not okay with the cost, we can do prison now. And they went back and forth on that. And the defendant said, no, I want to do probation. He said, well, let me be clear. If you violate probation and if you're unsuccessful, you will be going to prison. So, I mean, the roadmap was already there. And then come time for resentencing after the probation violation, I think that Judge Steinke did a sufficient job of explaining his reasons. He went through the fact that he had reviewed the pre-sentence. They hashed out what brought them to this case. And, you know, when we look back at the facts of this case in particular, too, they were pretty serious as well. I mean, they had allegedly several pounds of marijuana in the car. We had a high-speed pursuit. So this is a pretty serious offense in and of itself. And then he's placed on probation, and then we have the new offense occur, which obviously was manslaughter and a couple other serious charges as well. A few of them led to acquittals, but the manslaughter charge alone, with the allegation of drugs being involved after this drug-based conviction, was certainly enough for the court to have reached the determination that it did, in our view. We see no abuse of discretion there. But to answer your question, did the judge explain his reasoning? I believe that he did.
How does this court know what an abuse of discretion is if the sentence is within statutory boundaries?
Well, my understanding of our case law and the way I have always viewed it myself is that there has to be something that clearly shows from the record that the court has done or considered something that's improper or irrelevant to show that they've abused their discretion. Because if the sentence is within the statutory limits, there has to be something that shows that abuse. And obviously, if it's within it, I mean, the court has the discretion to go anywhere within those limits. So what has shown the abuse? If it's not something that shows that they considered irrelevant or improper information.
What would an example of irrelevant or improper be?
Like when I think back on the, I think it was the Patnell case from decades ago, where the sentencing judge was making comments about homosexuality, and they had no part of the case. It was just, and I think biblical verses were being recited, none of which had any relevance to the offense in question or the sentence to be imposed. And so that was reversed on the basis that information is irrelevant. Those are your personal views, and they have no bearing on our law or this offense in particular before you. So that's irrelevant, it's improper, and that's an abuse of discretion because your sentence is based on information that has no role here. So for me, that's, I guess, the most classic sense of when we're going to have an abuse of discretion is when you're taking extraneous information or improper or irrelevant information, and it's truly having a bearing on the sentence imposed in your case. If there are no further questions, we are withdrawing the plain error argument, of course, and we would ask, we don't believe that any abuse of discretion has been shown with respect to the sentence imposed. Mr. Saros is not entitled to relief on that claim, and we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel, that concludes arguments in state versus...